You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia, brought to you by iWalkUp, flexible loans built for small businesses. Today, we are in Feltre.
Cozze cittadine, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci ancora, non spigudeci ancora, cozze cittadine, cozze.
Where are we today, Lionel?
We're in Feltre today, Richard. We've come over Monte Grappa from Treviso, home of tiramisu. Well, the disputed home of tiramisu, the joint home of tiramisu. And big climb on the route of our Giro today.
What's How the other legs? Home? What's the other home of tiramisu, Napalm? Remember?
Yes. Not Watford, is it?
It's in Friuli, about 200 kilometres east of Treviso.
Tolmezzo,
excellent.
Yeah, got there in the end. And Redbourn, because I'll be making tiramisu towards the end of the episode.
I was refreshing my memory about Tolmezzo earlier today, reading some stuff. And Tolmezzo used to be, in the 18th century, it was recorded as the wettest place in Europe. Do you know where the wettest place in Europe is now? It's somewhere in Bosnia, not Scotland. I thought it'd be Fort William, your neck of the woods, but no?
It's not really my neck of the woods, Fort William, but... I guess Scotland's a small country for you, Daniel. It's probably more likely Hart Hill, where your ancestors hail from. A very kind of bleak and windswept part of Scotland. Apologies to any listeners in Hart Hill. What's coming up in today's episode, please, Daniel?
Well, Rich, we are going over Monte Grappa. Well, we're starting in Treviso, half of the home of tiramisu. And we're going towards Conegliano, birthplace of Alessandro Del Piero, famous son of this region. Does that mean anything to you, Rich? Famous footballer?
Oh, yes.
Well, then we're turning left and we're going through Prosecco Vineyards and we are heading up Monte Grappa. Now, I think there are 9 different ways to go up Monte Grappa. We're going up and via a sort of intermediate summit called Monte Tomba. Been scaled by the Giro before from that side, Monte Grappa.
Until today.
And then I'm not sure Napalm will make it this far because his chat was pretty pessimistic before the episode. But the peloton, the Giro peloton, will be flying down the other side, slaloming down the other side into Feltre.
Anywhere near Bassano del Grappa, where we had a very enjoyable evening last year?
Well, Rich, yeah, Bassano is sort of the south west, kind of at the foot of the mountain on the southwest side, and we're coming up from the east, so we won't unfortunately be stopping in Bassano. We won't be stopping at the Nardini distillery to buy some Grappa toothpaste, which I've still got 2 tubes that I bought last year. I wasn't very impressed with it, actually. But yeah, it's going to be a grandstand. It's going to be a blockbuster stage and a big descent down the other side to Feltre, and that's why today we're going to be talking mainly about descending. And those who have succumbed on descents, who have struggled on descents, those who have triumphed on descents in the history of the Giro d'Italia.
Yes, and we've got some interviews. We'll be hearing from Christian van der Velde, who had a nasty crash at the Giro, which he reckoned affected his career.
On the route today, Rich. We're actually passing the spot, unfortunately, for Christian.
Ah, sorry, Christian. And Stephen Kruiswijk, who some of you will remember, lots of you will probably remember, lost the 2016 Giro when he crashed on the Agnello on the descent, being put under pressure by Vincenzo Nibali. We'll hear from him, and we'll hear from Simon Yates, who is renowned, I think, as one of the better descenders in the peloton. So lots coming up, but we probably had the tail of the tapa there, have we? But have you got anything to add, Lionel?
Well, Daniel keeps going on about this wonderful descent into Feltre. So why does the RGT cycling stage that we're doing stop at the top of Monte Grappa? It's just climbing all the way for us.
Imagine a turbo session where you literally just got on your bike and just sat there, because you'd be freewheeling. It'd be great.
Absolutely.
All you'd have to do is sit on the saddle.
Well, Napalm, as usual, I was thinking of you, because in 1982, the Giro hasn't been over Monte Grappa that many times, but in 1982 it did go over Monte Grappa and they went down the other side towards Feltre, and the road wasn't tarmac. The road that they went down that year wasn't tarmac. It was a gravel road, and there were punctures galore. Beppe Saronni, who was one of the favourites to win that Giro, punctured six times on the descent. His team ran out of spare wheels, and so did the neutral service car. And I don't know where he got his seventh wheel from, but he made it to the finish, and he didn't. I don't think he lost any time either.
That at least is something you don't have to contend with when you're riding on a turbo. I should just mention, a few nights ago, Richard and I had a very enjoyable race to the finish line, didn't we? I was marking the early break on Wednesday night. I was about 6 or 7 minutes up the road. Richard reeled me in at the top of the last climb, and then claimed he had some kind of Wi-Fi problem. I mean, I'm not buying this. I waited for him, and then he just blasted past me in the finish straight.
I lost connection briefly, Lionel, while I was riding with you, because I was sort of doing so much else on my phone. I was doing a lot of admin and taking care of tasks like that while I was sitting on your wheel. You know, it was a good way to catch up with those kind of jobs, and briefly lost my connection and had to sit by the side of the road waiting for neutral Wi-Fi service, and got going again, and yeah, just went straight past you, didn't I? It was very reminiscent of Mark Cavendish's stage win at the Tour de France a few years ago, when he sort of slingshotted off. Was it
Bolsenhagen in Brive?
It was Bolsenhagen. Bolsenhagen helped him, but it was Luis Leon Sanchez, wasn't it? I think, who was up the road, and he just sort of got onto his wheel and straight past him. That was like me and you the other day.
It was
you were Luis Leon Sanchez, I was Mark Cavendish.
Like that. It was nothing like that. I mean, this surely shouldn't survive in the episode. Anyway, just a last quick word on Treviso. Very, very attractive, well-heeled town, isn't it? It's a very pleasant place. And the World Championship time trial events were held there in 1999. Fabian Cancellara won the junior time trial there. Jan Ullrich won the elite men's time trial there, and Jose Ivan Gutierrez won the under 23 time trial. Now, if I'm not mistaken, his nickname was the Buffalo, I think. Am I right?
I think that's correct.
Which,
yes.
Which Gutierrez?
Jose Ivan.
Wrong Gutierrez.
Oh, no.
That was Jose Enrique.
Yes, it was. Who was on the podium at the Vuelta, wasn't he? I mean, a Buffalo on the podium at the Vuelta.
No, he was, only a, time he was that's on the podium happened. At the Giro. He was on the podium at the Giro in 2006. That squeaky clean edition that we all remember. And he was subsequently outed. Well, he was outed a couple of months later. Well, not even a couple of months later. I think during the course of the race, as a client of Eufemiano Fuentes.
I don't think you need drugs tests to be suspicious of a buffalo finishing on the podium at the Giro.
Buongiorno a tutti, bonjour a tous, hello and welcome to stage 14 of the cycling podcast Giro d'Italia, a stage between Treviso and Feltre. 461 riders at the start, one non-starter, rider number 3, Lionel Burney from Watford, who miserably retired from the race after only 22 minutes of riding yesterday.
Sorry, no, I won't be taking question today, but I would just like to make a short statement. I'd been targeting the Intergiro classification, but unfortunately I was unable to complete the stage yesterday. I'm not a superstitious person, but it always struck me as a bad omen that stage 13 would take place on a Friday. There is absolutely no truth in the reports this morning that losing the sprint to Richard Moore the other day has affected my morale. I'm still very buoyant, and I'm planning to get back in the saddle for some of the mountain stages to come, and I fully anticipate crossing the line in Milan a week tomorrow. Thank you very much.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia. Brought to you by iWaka, flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Thank you very much to iWaka, our headline sponsor, without whose support we wouldn't be here, there, covering our Giro. Where are we, Lionel? I ask you that every day. We wouldn't be covering our Giro with daily episodes without the support of iWaka. Thank you to them. And iWaka, as we said a couple of nights ago, have been accredited by the British Business Bank to offer Sybils. Sybils, Lionel? Daniel, do you know what Sybil is?
Well, all Sybil, I think of when I hear Sybil is Basil Fawlty's long-suffering wife in Fawlty Towers, but I'm imagining that's not right.
I think of the Odyssey.
Aging. You think the Odyssey, you think Fawlty Towers. Anyway, it's not that. It's nothing to do with Fawlty Towers, probably fortunately for Iwaka. Fawlty Towers, not the sort of business they're probably looking to support. But CBILS are the Coronavirus Business Interruption Loan Scheme, CBILS for short. And these loans offer a lifeline potentially for businesses at the moment. Very favourable terms. You start repaying only after a year. The government pays all the interest in the first year as well. So if interested in CBIL, register that interest at iwaka.co.uk. You can go there now and register your interest. And while you're there, there's an awful lot of information there for small businesses about various support and loans available at the moment. Not all of them through Iwaka, but the information is on their COVID hub. Well worth having a look if you run a small business.
Amarcord, I remember.
Lionel, where are we?
Well, we're in Treviso.
We're not here to talk about cycling, are we? What are we here for, Lionel?
We're here for the World Cup.
Sort of.
Which World Cup is that?
Well, the Tiramisu World Cup. This whole thing has been a mystery to me since you mentioned that there's some great rivalry in the world of tiramisu.
Which has really become quite inflamed recently in the last few months. Tolmezzo, which is a place we're going to be going to tomorrow. And who knows, we might be tasting some tiramisu there as well. But Treviso, and in particular, the restaurant we're standing outside, Alle Beccherie, which kind of means at the butchers, they claim to have invented tiramisu not that long ago. We're only talking 3 or 4 decades ago, but I think we should go inside without further ado, because they're going to close the kitchen pretty soon, and find out what's what.
Well, first impressions, firm. Tasty, quite bitter chocolate on the top. Incredibly smooth and creamy, though.
A lot of chocolate on the top, isn't it?
I'm Andrea Corletto, and I work in a restaurant beccheria.
In principio, non si diceva tiramisù, ma si diceva...
So what was the gist of all that, Daniel?
Well, Lionel, fasten your seatbelt. First of all, the name. So originally it wasn't tiramisu, but tiramesu, which in Trevigiano, so the dialect of Treviso, means pick me up. Why pick me up? Well, the signora Campeol, so the lady who used to own this restaurant, formally registered this recipe in 1972 after she started eating a version of what we now know as tiramisu during what was apparently quite a difficult pregnancy. The signora Campeol... His mum gave her a mix of coffee, beaten egg and biscuits as a kind of tonic, a pick-me-up during her pregnancy. She duly had the baby, came back here and started talking to the chef about how to turn this egg, coffee and biscuit concoction with a bit of added mascarpone into a recipe. Didn't have any alcohol in it, precisely because it was created for women giving birth or about to give birth and indeed their children. Everyone's got their own recipe now, and you'll find grandmothers who put rum in, or grandmothers, that's what Andrea told me anyway, that put rum in or marsala, but the original recipe has no alcohol at all. On the whole, tiramisu wars with Tolmezzo, he says that it's true that the Hotel Roma in Tolmezzo used that name for a dessert first, but it was a different dish served in a cup and quite different from what the world now thinks of as tiramisu. The first people to get the recipe formally ratified were the Campiol family, and Le Beccherie was the first restaurant in the world to have tiramisu on its menu. Andrea was pretty confident as well that their version tastes better.
Well, that's all very well, but who actually won the Tiramisu World Cup when it was held in Bologna?
And they won. That was it. That's the last word on the matter. Domani andiamo a Tolmezzo. Comunque, il Giro d'Italia va a Tolmezzo. Andiamo nella Berga. Well, chaps, that was way back in, when was it, Napalm? 2018...
It was just 2 years ago. Feels like a lot longer ago, doesn't it?
It does, not least because, you know, there's been another Tiramisu World Cup since then, and it seems to have changed format. It's now an individual competition, and it was won last year by a gentleman called Fabio Pela. Well, he won the original. There are two prizes, two Tiramisu World Cups. One's for the original recipe, and the other one is for the creative recipe, and that was won by Sara Arrigoni. And she made a mojito-flavoured tiramisu. I'm not sure I approve of that.
No.
And they both then flew to the, as representatives of, as a sort of tiramisu envoy to some kind of bigger food festival in Brazil. And there was even a junior Tiramisu World Cup last year, but we don't cover that in the cycling podcast.
No.
Under 23 Espoirs tiramisu. That's, you know, below our pay grade.
At what point can you start putting booze in it? Is that not in junior level, well, I guess. Can't put masala wine in it at junior level.
No, I mean, of course, as discussed in the clip, you know, it originally wasn't supposed to have any booze in because it was designed for pregnant women initially.
That's right.
Anyway, I can see the buff's eyes are glazing over like a, you know, like a piece of cross starter that you might find on the breakfast buffet at the Giro.
Well, I remember, I mean, that was my first day back on the Giro in 2018. Really? I flew in thinking I was joining up with a bike race, only to find myself in the middle of some kind of food festival, pudding festival. And it was the Zonkalan stage, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. Yeah, and we nearly missed it because
literally the biggest stage of the race.
I was just wrapping my tasting spoon back up in its napkin before
I can't remember who won the Zonkalan stage, but I can remember who won the Tiramisu World Cup. What does that tell you?
It was a day where, well, you and I went up to the top of Zonkalan in the rickety old bubble car. Daniel went missing that day. We never found out what happened to him.
Well, I'm not going to reveal that now. Anyway, we should really talk about cycling.
It was the day of the royal wedding as well, and the happier days for Harry and
who
Meghan.
Won the stage?
Chris Froome. I do remember now.
Harry. Chris Froome. Simon Yates chased him all the way to the line.
It was like a foreshadowing, wasn't it?
Maybe Yates cost himself the Giro that day, and maybe Chris Froome will tell us that in a future episode of From Our Giro. But anyway, back to the topic in hand, which is going downhill, and we're looking at a few sort of Giro tales of descending where Giro's maybe been won and lost on the downhills. And you mentioned, Daniel, that we're today close to the scene of a very bad crash for Christian Vandevelde, the American rider, who, well, we're going to hear from him in a moment, but can you maybe put a bit of context to Christian's interview?
The sort of genesis of this, well, the interview and, you know, the reason for which we're talking about this today. So Christian Vandevelde had a terrible sequence of crashes, which sort of coincided or started really with the most successful period of his career. So in 2008, he finished fourth in the Tour de France. But the next 2 years, he crashed at the Giro and really struggled mentally, physically to get back to the level he'd been at in 2008. And around about 2009, I read an article in Outside Magazine, a fantastic article about a skier called Scott McCartney, who had a terrible crash at Kitzbühel. And it was a great piece written by Jennifer Kahn, is the name of the journalist. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. And the subject of the article was fear, really, and overcoming trauma, and you know, the sort of private battle that skiers fight, some of them unsuccessfully, some of them never overcome the fear of a bad crash. And it occurred to me that there must be guys in the peloton who are experiencing that or who have experienced that. Fast forward to 2012 and the Giro d'Italia, Christian Vandevelde was there riding as a domestique for Ryder Hegdal, who was trying to win the Giro d'Italia. I was also there and I contacted Christian about this theme, you know, his struggles with crashes and trauma and overcoming that trauma. And he said to me at the time, look, I'm in the middle of this, you know, race. I'm trying to defend the jersey or help Ryder defend the jersey. And to be honest, I'm really struggling with it at the moment. And so can we maybe do the interview another day? And it occurred to me then that, this was something that a lot of guys really fight a very private battle with. And Christian did sort of promise that we would one day discuss it in a bit more depth, and that's what we did a few weeks ago.
There's a little crash there at the back, just one of those as the referees like to call Phil, shoot sans gravité, but that doesn't like sans gravité to me. That looks a little bit like Christian Vandevelde on the ground,
and I don't like the way he sat there. In fact, that Zabiski has come up alongside him.
Well, that was a crazy crash. It was a simple crash just over to the right-hand side of the road, but it doesn't look to me as if Vandevelde is getting up from that one, Phil.
Well, this is, I have to say, a terribly sad sight, because surely Vandevelde's tour isn't ending right here now, but the riders have gone on. and he is holding himself extremely still. He is very tentative indeed. It looks to me, Paul, as though he could have fractured his pelvis here, the way he's sitting there, and I hope I'm totally wrong.
2001, breaking my arm, overshooting a corner, running into a light pole. That was pretty pretty rough one, and obviously being on U.S. Postal at the time and crashing out was rough for a young one, putting a lot of pressure on the shoulders. Man, there's too many to really talk about, but the biggest one really being in the Giro, where a touch of wheels or a failed wheel, whatever it was, all the spokes ripped out of my front wheel, and just had nothing left in my front, and just my forks went straight into the ground at 40 some miles an hour, and broke my, that's when I broke like 5 vertebrae and a rib and in my hip. So that was easily the biggest one by a long shot as far as big trauma goes. But I think by any kind of crash, and when anyone has something that happens, whether it's themselves or something that's completely out of their control, it takes a little bit of the edge off every time, and it takes a while to rebuild that confidence in not only yourself but everyone around you. And I would say more of the people around you that you don't necessarily trust people, and that's where you need to be relaxed within the peloton and on the wheel, or you're just gonna make it harder and harder for yourself. You know, in hindsight, a lot of things would be different. Let's just put it that way. I don't know if I would have even done the 2009 tour. I mean, it was good for my ego to go and get top 10 again on the heels of getting fourth the year before. But, you know, I was doing it with one arm behind my back, and I wasn't at top speed, and it took me years for me to get back up to feel like myself again after all that trauma to my body.
You know, when the chips are down, and I need to be up there, and I actually had a reason to take risks, then I had no problem. But it was more the fact of when I was in, like, top 20, something like that, and I was like, I don't need to do this. I'm not going to take any chances here. That's when I was really, or if it was in the rain or some things like that, I would just completely put my hands up and say, no, I'm not, I'll take the risk of coming back after the descent. That was, you know, on the heels of that, like 2010, where I really wasn't 100% right. Later on in my career, like in the Giro with Ryder and things like that, I wasn't that bad. It took me those 2 years. I skied later on in life, but, you know, I even took some like driving classes and things like that to try to think about ways to get the fear over a little bit. On the track, but not, I mean, it really wasn't that. It was really just scared of people around me, not really trusting people around me a lot of times as well, more than anything.
Is this a thing that at any given time in the peloton, you think there are a lot of guys who are going through their sort of private battles with this, and you know, people don't really talk about it that much, or do you think it is probably restricted to a few guys who have had particularly bad experiences? What's your sense?
I would say that. Yeah, I would say more of what you said at the beginning. I think there's a few people who have had realized how bad it can be, and you have that little bit of fear in the back of your head after you've had big crashes. And yeah, I think everybody, you know, when you're ripping down those descents, sometimes it's great and everything's perfect on your bike and you're feeling it, and other times everything's wrong. And you know, I even go back to, we had a couple bad years of really bad tires. Where we had, they were cooked in transit on the way back from Asia or wherever they're coming from. And so that was another one. And then we had another bad round of Mavic tires that if, you know, someone had a little bit of water coming from the front yard, we're all going down. So all those kind of things kind of built up to have self-doubt or not having confidence a lot of times.
Did you ever get the sense in that period that people were noticing people in other teams, people who didn't even know you never spoke to, and did you feel any kind of, well, embarrassment, which then increased the anxiety?
Oh, for sure. I mean, because I knew that, I know all the people who I didn't want to be behind on descents, you know, and so I knew, and so you always want to be forthright, you know, and make sure that everyone's okay around you and never want to put anyone in danger. At least that was my mentality. But yeah, you have people that, I knew every person that I didn't want to be behind in descent, trying to get ahead of them before the top of the hill at all times. So I'm sure it was no different.
And those guys over the course of a career probably don't get that much better, because they do live with that sort of tension of also, yeah, an anxiety of being watched and everyone knowing that they're not that great.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, some of those guys, you know, that happens when they're 23 years old and they just never really get over it or never really feel have the confidence on it. And it really is. It's all it is confidence. So you go there and you could see it so much better and relax. And then when you don't have it, it can be worse than the climb itself. I mean, tension, not seeing the road as it should be, not having the confidence to lay the bike down through the corners and push it to the maximum that you know that you can push it to. Yeah, but yeah, it's all tension, and then you throw the balance of the bike off. Yeah, and it just looks completely awkward.
And to what extent can you practice it in training? Or is that not really a good way of simulating it?
Yeah, I think it would be almost impossible. You know, you think of what you do on open road at 70, 80, 90 kilometers per hour. Where are you going to do that on an open road when somebody could be coming the other way and you can only use half the road? So it's one of those things that you can push it, you know, and you could push it all the time. Like, you know, Froome's a good example of pushing it. He's found himself on the bottom of the car a couple times just because he does push it all the time.
I'm not going to say they're the worst, but I would say like, you know, Fabian Cancellara was incredible to go behind. Because there's guys who go fast and it's terrifying. And there's guys who could go fast and it feels controlled. And it's a big difference. You know, it's like being with a great driver and you don't feel like you're going that fast, but the way he goes to the apex of the corners and the braking, everything is perfect. Whereas you could still be going 100 miles an hour, whereas somebody's going 90 and you feel like you're going to die the whole time. So Fabian was that guy that you could follow and absolutely destroy a descent and not feel like you really took that many risks.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Seb Piquet there interrupting this episode from Our Giro to remind us to tell you that it is sponsored by Stitch Fix. Do you fancy a little pick-me-up? Stitch Fix is an online personal styling service for men and women where an expert stylist picks clothes just for you based on your taste, size and price preferences and sends them straight to your door. Perfect if you want to discover something new or if you don't like clothes shopping or if you're not really leaving home at the moment. Traditional clothes shopping isn't an option for any of us just now, but Stitch Fix are here to help you treat yourself without leaving the house. Stitch Fix personal stylists, who all work safely from home, are ready to select you 5 surprise items. How does it work? Well, it's easy and actually really fun. You go to the Stitch Fix website, complete a style profile about your clothing preferences, shapes, sizes, and what you like to wear. Then it's over to your stylist, who will hand select and send to you 5 items of clothing and accessories, which you discover when they arrive at your front door, along with a card including outfit inspiration and style tips. Try everything on, keep and pay for what you like, send back the rest. Delivery and returns are free, and includes an optional free home courier pickup, particularly ideal at the moment. Stitch Fix have also extended their try-on window from 1 week to 6 weeks, so you've got extra time to send anything back, which again is pretty handy. And the best bit, you pay just £10 for your stylist time, which is redeemable against anything that you keep. If you fancy giving yourself a treat, then get started with Stitch Fix. Go to stitchfix.co.uk/cycling right now. That's stitchfix.co.uk/cycling. Well, we heard before the break there from Christian van der Velde talking about you know, the effects of crashing on his ability to go downhill. And also, as you mentioned, Daniel, it's really interesting and telling that he was so reluctant to talk about some of that while he was still competing. There's such a, I guess, there's a stigma, but it's also a it also makes it harder to do your job, you know, being forced to confront it like that, and maybe earning yourself a reputation as somebody who might be feeling a bit of fear going downhill. That's the last thing a rider wants to admit.
It's one of those things as well that's really poorly conveyed by TV pictures. You know, we have no sense at any real time. I mean, you sometimes see guys going backwards and you see guys missing bends and, you know, choosing the wrong lines on descents. But you don't really know who is experiencing fear, and it can come as quite a surprise to find out that a lot of these guys are scared a lot of the time. If I can mention another podcast, and if I dare mention the controversial Lance Armstrong, he did a very good podcast with another skier, Boda Miller,
In which they talked about this in some depth. And, you know, even Armstrong, who was renowned as a good descender, talked about how at times he was absolutely petrified. And and as I say, you know, it is something that is not really communicated through TV pictures. Funny enough, I was thinking that about another sort of sub-discipline of cycling the other day. I was listening to Mitch Docker's fantastic podcast about the 2014 Giro and the team time trial there, and this last pull by Swain Tuft that day, which kind of will go down in legend, you know, in history, among the people who were there in the team and who knew what it took. But if you watch the TV pictures, you don't really get any idea that it was anything other than routine. And that's often the case with descending as well.
It's a failure, an inevitable failure of the TV coverage, that, you know, getting right and close enough in team time trials, but also on descents, you know, you can imagine what the footage could look like if the technology was there. You know, I'm thinking in Formula One now, you know, with some of the cameras on the cars and in the cockpits, the sense of speed and that you get and the fear that the drivers must feel. But as you say, Daniel, that's not really conveyed all that well in cycling coverage. And you think about, well, what's the next frontier of broadcasting? It could be conveying that more accurately and better. And it goes for team time trials as well, where the team is riding as a unit, and it can be kind of hard to pick the riders apart.
I mean, I defy you, I challenge you to go back and watch the highlights of that team time trial. I mean, it's so, in Mitch's podcast, it's so sort of vividly and viscerally conveyed, and it sounds so exciting. And you go back and watch the pictures, and you just really see, you know, these sort of automatons going around the course with no real sense of anyone struggling or them even going particularly fast.
But 15, 20 years ago, even in the French TV coverage at the Tour de France, and I guess the Giro would be the same in Italy, the ad break would come once the lead group had gone over the top of the mountains, wouldn't it? And then pick them up as they're going down the descent. There was no real sense that the descending was part of this. We had a kind of detached idea of it as a visual spectacle, often from the aerial shots from the helicopter. Presumably that's because of the logistics of the camera bikes going down amid the riders as well. But it does feel like, and this is only anecdotal, and perhaps because of Nibali, the way Nibali won in 2016, and we have seen a lot of stages, crucial stages of both the Tour and the Giro, finishing with descents. It does feel like the descending has become more appreciated part of stage racing in perhaps the last 6, 7, 8 years or so.
I think more emphasis is given to it now. Just to bear that out, there's one team that has worked extensively with a descending coach. There's a gentleman called Oscar Saez, who's got a sort of downhill mountain biking and I think motocross background, hasn't he, Rich? Anyway, he has been working with what is now Jumbo Visma for a number of years. And just on that napalm, you know, that it now being given more importance. I remember him telling me that his first ever presentation to that team, I think it was about 2011 or 2012, he brought up an article from, I think it was Cycling News, about Andy Schleck. Andy Schleck was talking about how he'd done all this work in the wind tunnel, and he went on and on about it for paragraphs and paragraphs, and then he just mentioned, well, he alluded to the fact that in his opinion, the descents were too dangerous in the Tour de France the previous year, or something along those lines. And Oscar Saez, you know, sort of used this as an example to the riders that they really should be devoting as much attention to descending as they do to things like time trials.
One of the interesting, I spoke to Oscar Saez as well. One of the really interesting things he told me was one that he would work with road professionals on mountain bikes, get them to, you know, get on mountain bikes, because in downhilling on a mountain bike, crashing is a sort of accepted part of it. You know, that you can't really work out where your limits are unless you occasionally go over them. And downhill mountain bikers will actually study footage of crashes and really analyse where they've gone wrong and where to put it right the next time. Do road riders can't do that because that sort of footage doesn't probably exist a lot of the time. You know, again, going back to an earlier Our Giro episode, I thought the, you know, in the interview with Richie Port, Daniel, the bit that appeared on the Friends feed. He talks about his crash at the Tour de France a couple of years ago where his wheel locked up, and how at the time he was criticised for being a bad bike handler and for making a mistake, when actually it was an equipment failure and there was actually nothing at all that he could do about it. But, you know, then I remember just seeing the incident and coming to that conclusion too, that it had been a mistake by Richie Port. But Oscar Saiz says that he can get riders to go downhill quicker, but his number one priority is safety, and his number two priority is safety, and his number three priority is safety.
But number four priority is tiramisu.
Speed. Oh, nice link back. But you mentioned Nibali, Lionel, and he is the rider who perhaps is most renowned for his descending skills. And, you know, he's also somebody who sometimes makes mistakes. I'm thinking of the Olympic road race in Rio, or whether he makes a mistake is open to question, but he crashes sometimes. But importantly, that doesn't seem to affect him in the way that it maybe does affect some other riders. And in 2016 at the Giro, a few months before that Olympic road race, you could argue that he certainly laid the foundations for his Giro win that year on a descent.
There we go again, the Cannibali, the Vincenzo Nibali fan club from Tuscany, where he was based as an amateur. Ragazzi, non è retto a caldo, non avete mai dubitato?
No, fin dal primo momento sapevamo che andava a finire così. Sì. Infatti questo giro l'ha vinto, se l'è meritato.
Una parola in inglese?
No. Dai, no, siamo italiani, giusto parlare italiano, forza Nibali.
Forza Nibali, they didn't want to speak in English, but I think you got that. That was the Cannibali, Vincenzo Nibali's longtime fan club, just saying how happy they were and how they never really doubted that he was going to do it. Remarkable performance by Nibali, and we've seen his fan club at various races before the Tour de France last year. The Cannibali, they follow him wherever he goes, and it will be a long night of celebration for them, I think. Kreuzberg comes over the line and collapses on the tarmac. He's got his head bowed and he's sitting on the tarmac trying to compose himself here, and obviously heartbreaking for him. After the fall yesterday, he recovered brilliantly today, but ultimately it wasn't enough. Giro d'Italia that looked as though it was in the bag a few days ago, he now finishes, I think, in third place, although waiting confirmation of that, trying to raise himself to his feet now.
Well, we heard a clip there from our episode from stage 20 of the 2016 Giro d'Italia. That was the day after the critical stage that went over the monster Agnello. The Giro went into France that day. And Stephen Kreuzwijk, who'd been in the pink jersey for several days and looked good to win the race overall. He had a 3-minute lead overall. I mean, he was in a very, very strong position with two big mountain stages.
Yeah, I was licking my lips. I don't know if you remember, I had a lovely bet on Kreuzwijk, didn't I? Was he 50 to 1? No, I think he was more than that. Wasn't he 250 to 1? I was
He was an outsider. He was an outsider, wasn't he? But he had sort of ridden into a very strong position. And if you look back at his record at the Giro over the years, he'd been building up to that, you know, and he was lacking a strong team. The team that is now Jumbo Visma, you can probably trace its development into the team that's become back to that 2016 Giro, when they weren't really able to support Kreuzwijk as much as they could. And also they didn't know they had a rider like him possibly capable of winning a Grand Tour. But yeah, but on stage 19, as they crested the Agnello and began the descent, disaster befell Kreuzwijk. Nibali was putting the pressure on the descent, as he is wont to do, and Kreuzwijk lost control of his bike and hit an ice wall at some speed. I mean, he really slammed into it. And really, that was his Giro over, from the pink jersey and possibly winning the race to just struggling to finish. I spoke to Stephen Kreuzwijk a couple of weeks ago, and we looked back at that 2016 Giro and the day that his dreams of winning were crushed.
I was really relaxed at that point because, of course, I dreamed about getting a leader's jersey in one of the big Grand Tours, or know, in the beginning when I started my career and I did the Giro, you saw guys like Contador, and I was in the team with Menshoff, and especially Contador did a few times the Giro, and you know, he was the big man of that period, and sometimes I could fight with him in a race, and that was so gave me so much confidence to fight for more. And that year in 2016, at that stage when I took the lead or the jersey at the end of the stage, yeah, I was so proud of myself that I achieved this, just to be for one day or maybe 2 days already to have that pink jersey on my shoulders, and not, I didn't steal it. It's not like I came from a breakaway. I just fought for it like for 2 weeks, and I got it from the best riders, from Nibali, Chavez, and guys like that. And yeah, that was really for me a big achievement in my career, just to put on the leader's jersey in a big race. And I really dreamed of that. And so I was quite relaxed that I fulfilled that dream. And then I was just, okay, if I can do this, I maybe are one of the strongest guys in the race, and maybe I can take it till the end. And if not, then not. And maybe other guys are stronger, but I will fight for it every day. And that's how I took on the rest of the week in the Giro. And I think I did it on a good way, because our team was not that strong to carry the race or the jersey. But as long as I kept myself confident, and my teammates as well, they could fight for everything they could, and help me to get the jersey. And I think until the crash for myself, we were in a pretty good position.
Yeah, I mean, going into that stage, how were you feeling? Were the efforts starting to tell? I mean, did you feel that the race was yours to, you know, to try and win, or did you recognize that you had another two really hard days ahead of you?
No, for sure. I knew there were three really hard stages to come, but also after the day I took the jersey, we had the mountain time trial, which I finished second and took a lot of time again on my competitors. So I was really confident that I was also uphill, actually the strongest guy in the race. So as long as I kept it technically in the right hands, then I could control the guys. And the stages that followed, I always had one guy who wanted to work with me. One day it was Zachary, one day it was Valverde, then it was Chavez. It was always somebody with his own ambitions that were good for me. So. Well, for me, it was just looking for the right guys on the right day. And, Valverde was really on the hunt for a stage win. So one day I worked with him together to put the time on some other guys. So for me, it was just looking to the right guys on the right moment and try to control the race. And especially don't look too weak. And going into that final 2 days, which has been the... at the Queen stage and the hard finish on Saturday. I was quite confident, but I knew they were going to try to test me and my team. And so in the end, I knew also that I was going to be alone from my team. And I was hoping for a really hard race, actually, because then also the other teams would have not so many teammates in the front or somewhere else, you know, then was really like a man-to-man fight. So until the crucial day where I crashed, things were going pretty well for me. And I was showing a lot of confidence, I think. And even on the Col d'Agnello, where Nibali and Chavez launched a big attack, I was still in control. The only thing is that we didn't have the guys in the front to help me anymore, because it was a big breakaway. And in the end, that was technically a mistake, but yeah, I think still on the top I was in control. I for sure I was not easy to follow them, but I was still on their wheel. And we dropped, and again, another few guys like Valverde, Micah. So it was for the other guys to fight for the podium and for me to control my position. And as long as I would follow the first ones in the race, I was in a perfect position to maintain that, to maintain the lead. And I think if I didn't crash, they would have been fighting for the second and the third place just to keep off the other guys instead of attacking me. And but in the end, yeah, you know, I crashed. So they were fighting for the win. But until that point, I think I was quite good in control. And I also think that Chavez and Nibali saw that I was not easy to crack. And for me, it was always easy to just follow and sit in the wheels because I didn't have to attack. And they had to, Nibali especially, he had to gain time on other guys to be back on the podium. So actually, for me, it was the perfect situation to be in the front with Nibali.
Do you remember the moment where, you know, you did lose control on that and slam into that wall very heavily? What was going through your mind at that point? And was it a mistake, or was it you were trying to eat, I think? You know, was it tiredness? What caused it, as far as you're aware?
I think a combination of a few things. You know, you come over the top and you try to see what the situation is, and you try to take care of yourself by eating, maybe put on a vest because it was quite cold at the top. And the mistake I made, I think I was maybe putting in a little bit too much time into that instead of just be right on the wheel from Nibali, be focused for the downhill and follow him. And I was maybe too much in my mind with, okay, I have to eat, I have to drink, there's another climb coming up, take care of yourself, fuel up, and be ready for the final. So maybe I was doing that too much, so I lost a little bit of control to be right on his wheel. And he was going full in the downhill. And the thing is, I wanted to make up some ground by speeding up in the downhill. And in the end, I estimated the corners a little bit too. I am making an estimation of I can catch up here, and it wasn't. And I got off the road, and that's it. And it was just a small mistake with big consequences. And at the moment you crash, and a lot of things go through your mind. It's look for your bike, check it, and go on. But the problem was my bike was badly damaged, and there wasn't a car behind me. My handlebars were crooked and damaged. My front wheel was I don't know what was happening, but I couldn't control my bike anymore at that point. So I had to go really slowly on that bike and had to wait for the team car to pass. And that took a long time. I lost a lot of time with changing bikes. So a lot of guys passed me, like Valverde, the other guys, and then I was on my own. And then you have a lot of time to think, because it was quite a bit to ride towards the next climb, to the final climb. And a lot of things go through your mind, hoping you are just dreaming, or you want to wake up from this bad dream, because how could this happen, you know? You in from one perfect situation to the worst situation you cannot even imagine. And and in that moment you start to realize that it's out of control, and you're not gonna win the Giro probably. And after 20-25 minutes you start also to feel the pain from the crash, and then you know you have to do one final climb full gas much as possible. But it wasn't a nice finish of the stage, because you're losing your Giro. So.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think descending isn't a weakness of yours, is it, or anything? I know your team has done over the years quite a lot of work on descending. Have you ever worked Oscar size at all, or?
Yeah, true. Yeah, we did some training, especially with him. I don't think it's my weakness, but you know, nowadays it's more like some guys got really good at it and are ready to take risks in downhills, and I might be not that guy to take a lot of risks. So, but this is part of cycling, you know. It's so hard and difficult to beat each other uphill. That 1% or 2%, you cannot. If you're 1 or 2% better, it's still really hard to drop somebody on the climb. So the next thing you do is start to create a gap in the downhill. You know, like also like Nibali does a lot of times. Primoz showed his qualities in the downhill. So it's a part of cycling as well. And I wouldn't say it's a weakness of me, but it's especially not a weapon of me that I would create a gap in a downhill. And I just want to be in control, and maybe it's more like damage control because you don't want to take too much risk. You know, everybody once in a while crashes in a downhill, and you see things can be over by then. But yeah, the last few years, every race I rode for GC, you have to follow, and you have to follow the best and the fastest down the hill, and I did, and without any mistakes or that I was scared or anything. So, it's not a weakness of me, but I think you have to put attention to it. That is part of cycling, and that's also why we do a lot of, you know, the recons of the stages from the Grand Tours, you know, just to see how is this downhill. Do you have to be in front? Is this tricky downhill, or can it be slippery? You know, you have to suck up all the information that you can get to go as quickly and safely through this downhill. And that's how I take it in the race.
Just a point of order from the pronunciation police. Are we going with Stephen Kruiswijk? Our friend Dan Hackenberg said Kruiswijk. Yeah. But you know, we're a quasi British podcast, aren't we? Sort of.
Speak for yourselves. Anyway, Napalm.
But I think the thing is that when you're talking about the big mountains, the riders have been on the limit physically going up. You know, the fatigue is setting in, the mental concentration of climbing, focusing on the rivals around them, you know, calculating whether or not they're reaching the limit, working out what they've got left in the tank. You know, there's inevitably a sort of mental relaxation going over the top. And often, you know, those false flats are where strong riders make a difference, aren't they? And just open up those gaps. And then if you're off the back and chasing, the pressure is on. And we all know, even Daniel knows what it's like to go downhill relatively fast on a bike. It's one of the things that amateurs can kind of do, maybe not at quite the same speeds as the pros, but you can get up to pretty high speeds, just whether it's descending your local hills or going out and riding in the mountains. And everyone's had that little moment where they've felt the rubber just slip a little bit on the corner, and keeping their eyes out for the loose surface and looking at the barrier on the side, and just that mental moment where you think about, you know, what if this goes wrong? And that must be just sort of hammering at the outside of the rider's consciousness at every point when they're going down, and they have to block that out.
Well, just, I mean, that, you know, that descent of the Agnello, it wasn't super technical, was it, Daniel? I remember Ilner Zakarin also had a terrible crash further down. And it was, as Kruiswijk himself said, a mistake, and it owed to, you know, trying to refuel, trying to stay with Nibali, knowing that he didn't have team support with him. But, you know, you look at the lead he had going into that stage, 3 minutes over Esteban Chavez, who took the pink jersey after that stage, and 4:43 over Nibali. Nobody really would have fancied Nibali at the start of that stage to end up as the winner of the Giro. And I guess the question is, you know, if we cast our minds back to 2016, you know, would Kruiswijk have won that Giro had he not crashed?
Yeah, I think he definitely would. And it's definitely not the only Giro that's been won and lost primarily on descent. I mean, if we talk about the greatest descenders ever in the Giro and in cycling generally, one name that always comes up is Gastone Nencini. who won the Giro in 1957. He was from Tuscany, had a bit of a peculiar nickname that's difficult to translate into English. It's Pelaccia da Discesa, which kind of, I've translated it as the rawhide of the descent. There's a little passage here from a book written by a guy called Giacomo Pellizzari a couple of years ago. He may well have been the strongest of all time in this sport within a sport. He came down like he was on skis, Gastone. His descents were giant slaloms. His confidence through the hairpins was disarming. Apparently the rocks used to start rolling down towards the valley a second before he swept past, as though even they were afraid. They rained down on the back of whoever was in front of him. Cold sweats, a breath down the neck. Whoever was ahead of him was done before they even knew it. So that was Nencini and Napalm.
Well, the rawhide of the descents. Would it be better as the cowboy of the descents? I don't know. Is that taking it too far?
Pelaccia kind of means it's kind of a tough sort of animal skin.
Right, okay.
I'm not particularly au fait with sort of, you know, cowboy terminology, but rawhide, I don't know. I thought that sounded quite good. But Nencini was supposedly one of the best ever, but he also lost...
He was a chain smoker as well,
he was,
he?
And a painter, an amateur painter, apparently. Oh, wow. But he also, he lost a Giro on a descent as well, because on the Gavia in 1960, and the Gavia is probably one of the most unpleasant descents, one of the most dangerous descents the Giro ever does. And Nencini was all set up to win the Giro ahead of Jacques Anquetil on that descent. And in fact, he opened up a massive gap. But he got some duff information. I don't know whether, I think he was reading the old sort of ardoisier, they call it in French, the blackboard. And he got a bad time gap or the wrong information, and he sort of sat up at the bottom of the descent, and it allowed Anquetil to recoup some of what he'd lost, and Anquetil ended up winning the Giro by 28 seconds. So Nencini kind of fluffed that. Another one that was sort of decided on the descent was 1979. Knudsen was very well placed to overhaul Beppe Saronni in the final time trial there, but in one of the last mountain stages, he crashed the stage to Pieve di Cadore, and that scuppered his chances. There was some fantastic beef that I revisited the other day between Saronni and Moser after that stage. Just 10 minutes of them just sort of thumbing their noses at each other and sticking their tongues out live on Italian TV, saying, you should have chased. No, you should have chased. No.
No, you shut up.
Yeah. Look at my face. That kind of thing. But we really should do more. We should do more. It will probably be next year at this point, but on the Moser-Saronni rivalry, because it was that the pettiness was absolutely supreme, and also the intensity. And Moser, one thing, you know, we've talked a bit in the last couple of weeks about how parochial Italian cycling was in the 80s in particular. But Moser won 240 races in his career, which is, you know, staggering. A staggering number. But anyway,
Saronni come get to the end of the argument and say, I'm a bothered?
That it was that kind of, very much that kind of thing. Napalm, you're like this. Just on that 1979 Giro, did you know that 2 days after the Giro finished, the riders were sort of press-ganged into taking part in what was called the Gran Fondo d'Italia, and they were called upon to ride from Milan to Rome, 660 kilometres. 59 of the riders in that year's Giro took part. The main names, Saronni and Moser, opted out, but they arrived 19 hours later in the Olympic Stadium in Rome, and it looked like that the TV program was Superstars. They had a sprint after a 660-kilometer stage on the athletics track in the Olympic Stadium in Rome.
The only thing that would make that better is if they had to do wild camping. Then we could make a series for Explore about it.
Explore, brilliant.
Another one, 1987. Yeah. Oh, sorry, Rich. Were you gonna?
No. Sorry, yeah, 87.
87, yeah, chaps. Could you say that was decided on a descent?
Well, you were saying about the Giro being parochial in those days. We've talked about this, and Richard made a great friend special a couple of years ago with Stephen Roach about the battle between Roach and his Carrera teammate Roberto Vicentini. And I guess you could say it was decided on the descent, because Roach separated himself from Vicentini and the others on the descent of the Monte d'Est, which probably would have been, well, he said in the past, was a less controversial way to kind of attack his teammate. So doing it under the it's a bit more cloak and dagger than attacking on the uphill. And he was in a little group, one of whom was Jean-Claude Bagot, who rode for the Fagor team and was a kind of, he'd been sort of got on side, I think. He'd won a stage a little bit earlier in the race, and Eddie Schaper's Roach's right-hand man kind of basically persuaded Bagot to help on the flat sections. And that was where Roach got his time. And then, of course, the sports director, Davide Boifiva, came alongside and told Roach to stop riding, and Roach said, no, I won't, and so on. And the whole Carrera team imploded on the road. And you could say, well, would Roach have been able to stitch up his teammate going uphill? Possibly not. Going downhill was maybe seen as an easier way to get away.
And he was a good descender, wasn't he, Roach? He won, did he not win the time trial down the Poggio earlier in that Giro?
He did indeed, yeah. They had a time trial which started right at the top, just before the bend, and finished down in San Remo. And Stephen Roach was the quickest. And even though he was the quickest, I mean, I don't think even he was terribly fond of the idea of a short downhill time trial. It's pretty much, we all know descending is part of the game. We all know it's one of the skills that the riders have to have. And we all know that the people at the front will put the pressure on, and it's up to those behind to weigh up the risks of whether to push or whether to hold back. But in a time trial, there's kind of nowhere to recover any, you can't ride it strategically, can you? I mean, normally in a mountain stage, you can at least say, well, the race is played out over 100 or 200 kilometres, whereas an 8 kilometre downhill time trial, putting the riders, pretty close to the coal face there in terms of persuading them to take risks. But yeah, Roach won that ahead of Lech Piasecki, 3 second gap.
And the other one, I would say, chaps, there's not too much debate about this one having been decided on a descent. And 2005, one of the great finishes to a Giro d'Italia, and the last mountain stage to Sestriere, going over the Colle delle Finestre. And there were probably four riders in with a chance of winning the Giro overall at the top of the Finestre. That was De Luca, Simoni, Rujano, and Savoldelli. Savoldelli was behind over the top of the Finestre. Savoldelli, one of the great descenders of all time. And
Il Falcon.
And actually, we can hear a bit of just a few seconds of what happened now.
Savoldelli vicinissimo a Gonciar. Alessandro.
Mamma mia, è proprio così incredibile. Come al solito, Paolo Savoldelli sta rendendo questa discesa incredibile, bellissima, e tra poco supererà, raggiungerà e forse rimarrà con Sergei Gonciar, ma bisognerà vedere se vorrà guadagnare ancora qualcosa in discesa.
So Savoldelli made up a huge amount of time on the descent there of the Finestre, and then he went on to take a very narrow victory in the Giro. But yeah, definitely one of the supreme Giro descenders, and probably one of the best descenders of all time. And again, Rich, as you were saying earlier about Nibali, Nibali does make mistakes on descents, and I always think it's the ability to correct the mistakes that's the key factor. I remember an unbelievable descent that Peter Sagan did into Gap in the Tour de France a couple of years ago, and it was just mistake after mistake. Pretty much on every corner, he made a mistake, but he was able to correct it because he was so loose, he was so relaxed, and he was so agile on the bike.
A little known fact about Paolo Savoldelli: who does he share a birthday with, both date
Miguel
and year?
Indura. No. Well, no, incorrect. Same year. Richard Moore.
Correct. Right. Yes, we are exactly the same age.
Stefano Garzelli.
Paolo Savoldelli.
Stefano Garzelli shares a birthday with Indurain.
He gets the cool nickname, the Falcon, and I get the Buffalo. It's just the way the cookie crumbles, I guess.
The anvil of Edinburgh when it comes to descending.
the cowpat of Cowden Beath. Where's Cowden Beath?
The Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to our longtime sponsor, Science in Sport. We heard a clip from a 2016 episode earlier, and that was the first Giro we did in its entirety, and it was thanks to the support of Science in Sport, who have stuck with us ever since, and are still offering 25% off to all our listeners. with the code SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. Thank you to Science and Sport. And speaking of fueling,
il ristorante.
Tiramisu is, in my opinion, the finest of Italian desserts. I don't think, controversially, that gelato aside, desserts are Italy's strongest area culinarily. But tiramisu is from the north of Italy, so up towards the Austrian border. Although that is disputed, there are two regions that claim to be the home of it, Veneto and the Friuli Venezia Giulia province, sorry for mangling that, which is up closer to the Austrian border. They're both mountainous regions. It's often claimed, so the name tiramisu means pick me up, literally. And there's this lovely legend, actually, it's created in, lovely, kind of lovely, it was created in brothels as a sort of pick-me-up for the girls working there between clients. But actually, there's no record of it before 1959, even that's disputed. So it's quite a recent dish, which doesn't make it bad. And there's an official Tiramisu World Cup, and the only ingredients you're allowed in the World Cup are Savoiardi biscuits, which are kind of like ladyfinger, almost like trifle sponges, mascarpone cheese, eggs, coffee, cocoa powder and sugar, and that's it. I think that the World Cup is missing a trick. I would put rum or some other sort of sweet or sweetish booze in there along with the coffee, and then just let it soak. It's kind of like an Italian trifle, and almost as nice as our own trifle. So yeah, I think the king of Italian desserts, wherever it's from. Okay, the tiramisu. My first thought was it looks delicious. My second thought, more, you know, putting my scientific hat back on, was it had a slight Leaning Tower of Pisa look to it. I was a bit anxious that it was about to collapse onto the plate. But generally, very positive. I was a bit worried that you hadn't really let the biscuits soak enough, because if you zoom in, you can see they're a bit pale in the centre, like you haven't quite let the coffee and booze soak into the middle of it. So they might have been a bit dry. I don't know whether they were a bit dry.
No, I'll say that they weren't. No, they weren't. I did have an issue with that came from one side. The other side, I possibly overdid it because the biscuits were collapsing and as I was putting them into the dish. So I was perhaps sort of balancing one end out with the other. The mixture was masala wine and espresso coffee from our coffee machine, and that worked a treat. And I have to say that we ate it, that picture was taken the evening it had been made. It was much firmer and yes, really kind of blockish, brick-like the following day. And actually the flavour, in a nice way, the flavour improved overnight as well.
Yeah, I think it is like trifle. It improves from sitting around. Brick-like is a quality that I look for in my desserts, so I'm impressed by that. There's a very generous layer of cocoa on top. I could almost feel my throat constricting. Did that make you cough as took a bite?
A couple of little moments where it caught in my throat. Yes, I must admit.
Dangerous stuff at the moment. Very dangerous.
Well, I just wonder, would it be enough to get me out of the group stage in the Tiramisu World Cup?
I think that you'd certainly you perform fairly strongly with that, but I would be, as a nitpicker, I'd be worried about those biscuits. I think you'd need to reassess your soaking protocol for the next round.
Well, chaps, I know you can't taste the tiramisu, but do you think? I think that's enough to get through to the knockout stages. Maybe get knocked out on penalties, though. Perhaps
going home beaten by Costa Rica. No, actually, it looks pretty decent, napalm, I would say. I'm quite impressed with the consistency of it, because I think it surprises some people when they first get
they first have really authentic tiramisu, especially from somewhere like Treviso. It's quite solid, isn't it?
Solid and, yeah, it well constructed. You don't want to have big gaps where the biscuit... You want the biscuits to just sort of soften into one another and the mascarpone to hold it all together like a good brick wall. Yeah, it was really tasty. And as I said, they tasted much better the second day. It benefited from a night in the fridge just kind of brewing in coffee and masala wine.
Looks like that was a general portion you gave yourself there, Lionel.
I don't know if you remember, Napalm.
It's a very, very small plate, Richard.
Napalm, I don't know whether you remember, but when we did have the original tiramisu at Le Beccherie in Treviso, we also had a tiramisu sbagliato, like a tiramisu gone wrong, and it had some Prosecco in it.
Well, I was going to ask whether a glass of Prosecco would go with a big wedge of tiramisu.
Vino del giorno. Cin cin.
As most cycling podiums have a sparkling wine of some sort, so should the cycling podcast Full Giro and Baby Giro. So today we're looking at the Casa d'Effra d'Arello, which is harvested from vines in between Vicenza and Verona. The soils in which the vines are grown are volcanic, so it really shows a little more minerality than most Prosecco. It shows off some sort of citrus floral notes with a little bit of honey and a zippy green apple crunch, making this a really refreshing, uplifting aperitif. Well worth trying. We hope you enjoy.
Oh, taking the lights out in your office there, Rich.
Didn't get the old saber out today, Rich. No,
I was
very disappointing.
I was hoping it would clatter off my tin roof, but that didn't quite reach the roof.
With his saber taking the cork out, you'll never take my wine.
Chaps, of course, this isn't even Prosecco. We're driving through the middle of, I think we're on the Strada del Vino, the Prosecco wine road, tourist route. On the way out of Treviso up towards Conegliano and then Valdobbiadene today, and we haven't even got a Prosecco. We've got a sort of left field Prosecco alternative from closer to Vicenza, sort of Pozzato country. What do you make of it, Rich?
Well, I'm the only one sampling
don't
it.
Say that.
Well,
I've
got my Giro stage to ride, and you know, I'm not like Jack Onkatiel, or you know, I don't want Freddie Martin.
That's the most accurate thing you've said this podcast.
I'm not Freddie Martins. I don't have a half a bidon of fizzy wine before a
stage.
Well,
he used to have almost a bottle in the last 30 kilometres, and he's just sent a domestic back for a bottle of champagne.
Similarly, Merckx as well, Guillaume Driessens, his long-term direct sportif, was famous for that, champagne bottles.
Yeah, I mean, our Giro stages are around 30 kilometres. If I had to polish off a bottle of fizzy wine, Prosecco or otherwise, before each stage, I'd be in a bit of a mess.
My tasting notes here, Daniel, are it's very dry. It's very, very dry.
Approvingly or disapprovingly? Because I like a bone dry sparkling wine, which
it's very dry.
Not everyone does.
So you might like it. I think back to our visit, our incredible visit to Laurent Perrier Champagne House last Tour de France, Lionel. And when we mentioned Prosecco, it was as if somebody had farted, wasn't it, in there? And Cava drew an even worse response.
It didn't go down well, did it? I tried to kind of lighten the... It was a very grand atmosphere, and I didn't realise that the dumb thing was not to compare one of the finest champagnes with... the sort of, well, as you remember, Daniel, when we were in the Friuli region and the very flamboyant man in his linen suit, and he had his sports car outside and his moccasins, and sort of mocking the British for polishing off all of the Prosecco that they crate up and send over to us. There was a bit of an edge to that, wasn't there? So I can see maybe it's not quite in the league of champagne, perhaps. But this isn't Prosecco anyway. But
well, my tasting notes in summary are very dry, 12%. What's next?
What's next? You're supposed to be the host. You're supposed to be heard these cats.
My mouth's full of not Prosecco.
Well, if you remember, Richard, before the break, we were talking about descending and the Giro d'Italia cycling. We were talking about Giri that have been won and lost on descents. And we were talking, we sort of mentioned some of the notorious descents in Giro history. Few more notorious, certainly in recent history, than the Monte Crostis. Remember that? Remember the story? 2011, there was going to be a fantastic stage up in Friuli, not far from Tolmezzo, which was going to finish at the top of the Monte Zoncolan, but the real sort of grandstand, the real showstopper on that stage was going to be the Monte Crostis, this climb the Giro had never been over before. There was a large section of white road, and there was this wonderfully theatrical recce that Alberto Contador did in the spring. He was riding for Saxo back at the time, and he sort of the cameras went with him, and it was all filmed. And at the top of the climb, just as he started the descent, sort of Contador turned to the camera, and his kind of teeth were chattering, and he was mopping his brow and saying, "Oh, this is terrible. They can't include this in the Giro. Surely, I think they should take it out." But they were, RCS and Maravegni were determined that it should be in the race, but the sort of the controversy rumbled on right up until, well, the eve of the race. Was it going to be in? Was it not? Was it too dangerous? And I think at 9:15 on the night before the stage, the UCI race jury decided that despite mattresses and all sorts having been erected on the hairpins, on the corners, and lots of money having been spent, they were going to take it out of the route. And there were thousands of fans the next day went onto Monte Crostis and just waited. And, well, didn't so much wait as they knew exactly what they were doing. They went up there to protest. So they stood up there all day while the race was taking place on the opposite mountain, the Monte Zoncolan, that they could see from where they were standing. But still never been in the Giro. The gentleman, the sort of regional governor, Enzo Cainero, who was sort of responsible for the Zoncolan being in the Giro the first time, said that recent Contador were assassins for scuppering his hope of the Monte Crostis being in the Giro. That's a very infamous one, chaps. The Gavia I mentioned, I think that takes some beating. Very narrow, very dangerous. But generally, you know, the Giro is obviously synonymous with the Dolomites. The descents in the Dolomites are generally not that bad. I mean, if you can imagine a Dolomite napalm, if you can picture a Dolomite, they often look you can imagine like a chalk ice sort of sort of sprouting out of the top of a wrapper, the ice cream bit being the rocky part, the sort of the instantly recognisable Dolomite part, and then the wrapper being a fairly sort of shallow, the sort of wooded, grassy bit where the road is generally plotted. You don't tend to get these big sort of drop-offs and big precipices in the Dolomites, and the hairpins are generally quite wide, and not the most formidable descents on the whole.
Well, you mentioned earlier Daniel Peter Sagan and his ability to descend and make up for mistakes through being loose and relaxed on the bike. And it's tensing up, isn't it, that often leads to mistakes and crashes. And that ability to be relaxed is very important, but difficult too if you're scared. And that appears to be part of the trick, as we'll hear in our next interview from a rider who is renowned as a good descender and also a great bike handler, Simon Yates from Mitchelton Scott.
I believe a lot of it is how you grow up. You know, you always see the guys who come from mountain biking or cyclocross, you know, they're great bike handlers for a reason. I think riding the track also helps, which is obviously how I started. So I think, you know, those sort of things really improve your descending, and you learn a lot of it just from being a kid, just from growing up riding a bike. You know, I didn't do anything to really, you know, I'm not trained to descend, you know what I mean? Like some people work on it because they're not very good at it. But I think it comes naturally with some things, how you grow up. Like big crashes, of course, it always takes a long time to have confidence again. But I've luckily never crashed on a descent. A lot of the descents here are really technical. But here in Andorra, they're all smooth roads, which I think makes a big difference. You know, you go to different parts of the world and the descents are in terrible condition. So I think it really depends. Of course, the more time you do something, the better you'll become at it. So I think, you know, since I moved to Andorra, I believe I've become a better bike rider in general, not just descending. So for sure, it's helped. You know, there's always a bit of a race. Say we're going over a climb and then we're coming onto a long descent. There's always a race to the top anyway to, you know, to fight for position. So you have a good position on the descent. But half the time, it's just to get in front of these guys who you don't want to be behind. I won't name names because I don't want to. You know, they're good riders, and you put them in any other race, they're good descenders. It's just that, you know, at this level, it, you know, every millimeter counts, every centimeter counts on the road. So, but you know, there's say two handfuls, you know, of guys who you want to be in front, and unfortunately for me, they're all strong guys, so it makes my job harder to get in front of them on top of the climb. That we have a good position. So yeah, there's a few.
And do you often still experience fear on descents? I mean, would you say that you do?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. You know, I'm very confident in my ability and also my equipment, which I think for me personally has the biggest effect on confidence is my equipment. You know, when I fully trust a tire or a bike to you know, or the brakes, you know, to be able to stop, and that's the biggest advantage or disadvantage you can have. Because as soon as I know that I'm on, say, you know, I've been lucky enough in my career to always be on good, a good tire supplier. So, it's not, you know, but before I was a professional, I was using, you know, tire sponsors that I didn't like, I didn't have confidence in. And I was one of those guys, you know, who I want to be in front now, because you know, you don't have confidence and you start leaving bigger gaps, and all of a sudden there's a split in the bunch. So and I've been there before, and I think that brings it back to just your, you know, having, you know, confidence in your equipment. I think in the heat of the moment, I think in the heat of the moment when we're really racing and it's going down, I don't even think about it anymore. It's not something that crosses my mind. It's, you know, you're completely focused on the race. Not really on, you know, descending, making sure you're taking the corners correctly and stuff. It almost comes naturally at that point.
Well, Simon Yates there, very interesting, I thought. You know, certainly not bigging himself up as one of the best descenders, but admitting to that thing that a lot of riders don't really want to admit to, which is fear. Because admitting fear means often making yourself vulnerable and encouraging others to try and exploit that perceived vulnerability on descents. And, you know, I thought it was fascinating hearing him talk about knowing which riders do struggle on the descents and how there's a race to kind of avoid them. I've heard also Oscar Saez, actually, the descending coach, talk about how the fear or the apprehension of the descent can really affect good climbers, you know, in the final parts of the climb. It can leave them also feeling kind of unrelaxed and a bit stiff, you know, in the closing stage of a climb, which can affect their performance going uphill as well. The nerves starting to jangle ahead of the descent. But yeah, interesting. I don't know if there's anything else that you picked up from Simon Yates, either of you.
Well, just on that pressure factor, Rich, and, you know, the sort of fear that can build in some riders as they, you know, approach a summit. It was something that Merckx, I think, really capitalized on late in his career when he was no longer making the difference on the climbs. You know, he would often attack just before summits, just simply to begin the descent with pressure already on his adversary. You know, it was something he tried a lot in 1975 against Bernard Thévenet, and it didn't ultimately work, and Thévenet beat him. But it was also a sort of sign that Merckx's powers were waning. But, you know, Nibali did that a lot in 2016 as well. You know, couldn't necessarily open up much daylight on the climbs, but he would often put the pressure on it on the last kilometre of climbs. But, yeah, it's something that becomes a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy for the guys who are slightly less
able on descents. I mean, Christian Vandermeer mentioned how guys can sort of develop this reputation early in their career, and then they become embarrassed or they become conscious of all eyes being on them, and then they become even stiffer and they become even worse. I mean, on the other hand, you have riders who overcome the problems that they experience early in their career. I mean, Thibaut Pinot, based on what we've seen in the last couple of years, he's overcome the terrible problems that he had at the start of his career. I mean, you know, in 2014, they sort of ruined his Tour de France, his issues on descents. There were comments from other riders. I remember Romain Bardet saying that he did everything he could to try and avoid being close to Pinot on descents. And again, that was something which exacerbated the difficulties that Pinot was already experiencing.
I would throw Chris Froome into that mix too. Somebody who, when he began as a pro, you know, his bike handling skills were lacking. And then, you know, after a few years, he was a guy who could attack on descents and you know, lay the foundations for a Tour de France win, certainly on a descent on the stage that finished into Luchon in 2015, perhaps, was it, I think? 2016. And also the Giro that he won in 2018, you know, he obviously attacked on the Finestre, but on the descent, he made significant gains there too.
Yeah, it's interesting that tour that Froome effectively did win on the descent, didn't he? It was almost like Team Sky had got so fed up with being sort of criticised for strangling the race on the first sort of big mountain top finish that they tried something else and pulled off the element of surprise. And I think that still is something that is quite important when it comes to assessing the descents. If everyone kind of knows that this is going to be a descent where some gaps could open up, everyone's a bit more kind of alert and ready for it. But the element of surprise on those stages where they finish down in a town rather than up at the top, and it keeps us entertained and interested in the race these days. Whereas in the past, as I said before, you'd often think, well, that's the stage kind of done. Everyone will get down to the finish now in the order that they went over the top. And that isn't a given these days, partly, I suspect, because of the techniques, partly because of the equipment as well. So it's become it perhaps was an underestimated dimension to bike racing, even by the riders, until, you know, the last decade.
And as Kreuzwick said, the part of the reason for that is that the margins between the top riders and the climbs are so small now that, you know, it can pay off to focus a little bit.
Well, think of the energy required to gain 30 seconds on a Hoare category climb or first category climb compared to 30 seconds opening up in really a couple of hairpins on a mountain descent, can't it? I mean, that's the difficulty, you know, when it comes to going downhill. It's taxing mentally, physically, and you know, the sort of the concentration levels required as well, not inconsiderable.
Sitting here starting my second glass of bubbly here, I feel like I'm at a wedding. Should we wrap things up? What's coming up tomorrow, Lionel?
Well, tomorrow we're looking at the visual Giro d'Italia. We're going to talk to Graham Watson, legendary photographer, spent many years among the riders in the peloton, photographing from the back of a motorbike. He says that the Giro d'Italia is his favourite race to cover. We'll also hear from some people on the kind of the style aspect of the Giro d'Italia, which definitely stands head and shoulders above the Tour de France and the Vuelta, doesn't it? I mean, you can't beat the Italians for style on and off the bike.
And before we go, thank you to some friends of the podcast. Some of you have signed up as friends of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com, where you will get lots of special episodes and also access to our first ever film, And So We Rode, with Conor Dunn and Larry Warbass.
Just on that, very quickly, Rich, we have sent an email out to everyone who is registered as a friend of the podcast for 2020. If you haven't seen an email, do check your junk or spam folder first. And if you still can't find the email, drop us a line at contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. Don't kind of, you know, labour on thinking, oh, why can't I watch this film? We want you to be able to watch it. So drop us a line if you're having problems, and Jonathan Rowe will sort you out as quickly as he possibly can. Please try not to kind of ask for tech support on social media. We have been having quite a lot of messages on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Very difficult for us to deal with every query on social media. So if you've got a problem regarding any of the audio or visual in the podcast, just write us an email and we'll get back to you.
Yes, and thanks very much for all the feedback on the film as well. So from me, thanks to the following friends of the podcast: Murdoch McPhee, Jamie Brocklehurst, Pike Talbert, Adam Wright, Steve Lampier, and Alan Bissaker.
Pike Talbert emailed us last week, and I haven't got around to replying yet, Pike. I'm a little bit behind with the correspondence because I've been riding and recording our Giro, but once the Giro's over, I'll clear through our inbox. But thank you from me to Richard J. Roberts, Dave Church, Dapper James, Garrett Turley, Andy Galloway, James Forbert, and Dapper Freeb.
What? Thanks from me to John Reppy, Robert Summers, Njol Nordmark, Graham Lanigan, Oliver Reeves, and Michael Flynn.
I wonder if Dapper James is actually James Dapper.
Oh,
sorry, James. Yeah.
You provided the list of our friends.
Sorry.